Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're opening with our first field report in more than 5 weeks as we head to Newtown to visit and learn about the community's first ever drive-up COVID-19 testing centers. We'll chat with a Physician One representative as well as the community's lead health official in Newtown's first selectman about the role COVID testing plays in a greater reopening strategy ahead of the May 20th Phase 1 statewide reopening efforts. Then we'll celebrate all the frontline responders as we kick off National EMS Week here in Connecticut. We'll talk with a small-town EMS provider in the Naugatuck Valley and a municipal fire department official in Middletown about how those agencies coordinate with emergency dispatchers and medical professionals as they work together to save lives and protect us 24 hours a day, and especially during the current pandemic. And we'll close with a medical expert representing Greenbrook TMS Neuro Health Centers with locations across Connecticut. We'll get a crash course in what transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, is all about, how it's helping folks with clinical depression, in some cases weaning themselves off pharmaceutical treatment options, and how TMS might serve you if you're experiencing depression or heightened anxiety as a result of the ongoing coronavirus emergency. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Connecticut's United Way's Alice Saves program has partnered with Neighborhood Trust Financial Partners to offer a free financial coaching program available online and by phone. Known as Trust Plus, the program provides one-on-one support for clients with challenges such as dealing with creditors, finding emergency resources, and reducing debt. The program is available to all Connecticut residents, but has particular relevance for easing the burden on those struggling financially amid the COVID-19 pandemic. If you want to sign up for Trust Plus, just text Alice Saves to 646-349-5959, then click on the button to sign up and select the neighborhood trust budget coach of your choice, or just learn more at ctunitedway.org.
So I'm out in the field today for the first time in probably about 6 weeks, and pleased to be at the first drive-up testing center in Newtown, Connecticut, being handled by Physician One. And I'm here with Melanie White, who's the area operations manager for Physician One. Melanie, this is Newtown's first testing center, but not Physicians One first testing center.
That is correct. This is probably test number 7 or 8 of the drive-through events that we've been doing here at Physician One.
So tell me a little bit, to the best of your knowledge, about how this whole kind of thing ramps up when it's a kind of public-private partnership. You guys are a for-profit urgent care initiative, but our governor and health officials across the state have been pushing for these kind of things for quite a long time. Was it a process to make that bridge between the government and Physician One and rolling all these out?
Sure. No, it's actually been a fairly seamless process thus far. Getting tests out there to the public has been a very strong initiative by everybody, be it the government as well as Physician One Urgent Care. So we have been very successful in rolling out these drive-through testing events. Like I said, this is maybe number 7 or 8, and we're testing about an average of 200 patients per day at most of our testing sites. So we have had really great success getting this out there to the public and having, you know, primarily our first responders, our essential workers, and then broadening it out to the general public as well. We've been very successful.
I imagine Physician One and your colleagues played a really critical role in the early stages back in February and March as well, when they had to kind of parse individuals who may have been early stage COVID-19 candidates versus people that were starting to experience the early onset of allergies, the back end of the flu season.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been very, very challenging.
It has been very challenging. We have wonderful clinicians who have, you know, spent their hours tirelessly researching and developing our protocols for diagnosing patients properly. We have a phenomenal chief medical officer, Dr. Jeannie Kankery, who has been working with our providers on a daily, hourly basis, rolling out new protocols that have come down from the CDC and different guidelines, different symptoms to look out for. So we have been, you know, since day one, we have really hit the ground running as far as ensuring that we are giving the patients the, you know, proper diagnosis and the experience that they deserve.
What are a couple of the other things that, if any, that Physician One is doing or is going to be doing in terms of like antibody testing or any other initiatives to further integrate your colleagues in your company with these governmental efforts to try to track and stop this insidious virus?
Absolutely, yeah. Physician One is currently doing the nasopharyngeal PCR testing daily at all 23 of our locations throughout New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. We are also doing antibody testing every day at all of our locations as well. So we, you know, since day one of antibody testing, we have really hit it hard as far as wanting to make sure, you know, primarily, again, the first responders, essential employees, have the antibodies if they've been exposed to a positive COVID patient. We are doing that on a daily basis across the board at all of our centers to ensure that we can try to keep the public as healthy as we can.
So people, for people who are listening across Connecticut and possibly on Long Island, I you're out there as well, I think.
We are in New York.
Right? Yeah, so for people that may be listening on the air on our podcast, can you just walk them through what they're going to experience? I understood from the preview release for this event that we're at here today in Newtown on Thursday that you did prefer at least folks to get pre-screened.
Yes, generally we do require a pre-screening for our visits that are seen in our clinic. Now that we're doing these drive-through events, you know, we're popping up all over the place, we're actually doing an on-site provider evaluation. So the patient will essentially make an appointment or a reservation to come to the drive-through event. We will verify their name and date of birth at our registration tent. They will then proceed up to our provider tent, where they'll be asked, you know, a series of questions, screening questions, past medical history, ensure that, you know, they're feeling okay. Let's do a brief intake, and then from there they'll proceed right up to our testing tent. We are here on site today. You'll see that they're doing a nasopharyngeal swab, which detects active COVID virus.
So, you know, we've been hearing a lot about the various types of testing that are in production, spit test, the nasal swab, and others. Obviously, the nasal swab can be somewhat uncomfortable. Yes. Is there anything at all that people can either mentally or even physically prepare for so that the experience is as smooth and as comfortable as it could be?
Yeah, the nasal swab is, it definitely should not be painful. It only takes, you know, about 5 to 7 seconds to do the swab. It's an uncomfortable feeling. It might make your eyes water a little bit. It might make you feel like you have to sneeze, but it generally should not be an uncomfortable or painful type of event.
And in terms of folks who might be coming to Physician One for general feelings of illness, do you have any protocols in place that's going to make it safer for both the patient, potential patient, and the staff?
Yes, absolutely. That is something that is very near and dear to our heart. We want to ensure that all patients and our staff are equally protected here. So we have a couple of options. Patients can be seen via a virtual visit by going through our website, www.p1uc.com. They can schedule a virtual visit to be seen right from the comfort of their home. If they need to have any testing done, they can then drive to one of the 23 locations, and they can have their testing done right at their car side. Whether it's a strep test, a flu swab, a COVID test, whatever the case may be. Second to that, all of our visits that are coming into our clinics on a daily basis, say you brought your son in for a sprained ankle, we're going to do an evaluation over the phone while you're sitting in the parking lot in your car to ensure that it is safe to bring you into the clinic for your safety and for the staff's safety. So we are very closely monitoring patients' temperatures, any symptoms that they're having. Any patient that comes into our office currently will be masked, as well as our staff is always wearing proper PPE.
Is there any idea at full strength how many Physician One drive-up testing centers may be planned in the future? Or are you right at capacity now?
No, we are. We're going to, you know, keep taking everybody by storm. We're hoping to put these up wherever it's needed. We've been working with a lot of town officials in our various locations to ensure that we have proper testing, again, on a daily basis, as well as on a drive-up basis like we have here today. But we are, you know, wherever they need us, we are happy to go.
Great. Hit them with the website one more time.
Absolutely. Our website is www.p1uc.com.
Very good. Melanie White is the Area Operations Manager for Physicians One. We're here at Newtown's first drive-up testing center. Melanie, thank you.
Absolutely.
Here in Newtown. We're also going to visit for a couple minutes with the community's Health District Director, as well as First Selectman Dan Rosenthal. Let's start with Donna Culbert. Donna, you're kind of in a unique situation in that you're the Newtown Health District Director. Newtown, one of the physically largest geographical towns in the state, population in, pushing up toward 30,000. But then at the same time, your district also encompasses the extremely small and suburban rural communities of Roxbury and Bridgewater. Are you noticing any similarities or disparities between the populations that you're managing and overseeing in those diverse communities?
Well, the similarities are very beneficial as far as, you know, each town has organized efforts to support individuals and families in need. And so that has kind of reduced a lot of pressure about people being successful and being able to isolate or quarantine. So those are, you know, really positive similarities between the towns. Bridgewater and Roxbury and Newtown, too. We're all very rural, but Bridgewater and Roxbury are very rural. Not a lot of local opportunity to congregate, so there's lots of space and opportunity to stay apart, be able to get the services they need. Of course, they do have to travel to get what they need or have it delivered to them. Newtown, a little bigger, more kind of central opportunities for people to interact, and so they've done a really good job as far as maintaining what I think is good social distancing, you know, sanitation, things like that. I'm trying to think of any.
Well, I was going to say, Newtown is kind of wedged at the northern point of abutting Fairfield County and abutting New Haven County, both of which are the two kind of hot zones still in Connecticut right now, at least in terms of diagnoses. But Newtown's, you know, the luck of the location, maybe, also abutting up against Litchfield County. You seem to really be having more of a Litchfield County experience in terms of numbers of positive cases and deaths from COVID-19. It's been, you got a population combined of in excess of 40,000, probably closer to 50, right? And your numbers have been pretty good.
Well, I do think our numbers been good. I think, you know, of course, I'm going to be a little biased and think that my district is the best. I think that we have, in general, I think we have some pretty healthy people with good health, but also they're very health conscious. And they have some good opportunities to maintain that health, you know, both at home and in the community. I think they take it very seriously, you know, trying to balance that. How can we manage our life and also be really careful that we protect ourselves, protect our neighbors and our family? So I appreciate that. I think my residents are working really, really hard to be safe, be conscientious of the effort, you know, not be too restricted. I mean, be the appropriate level of being restricted in their, you know, in their life and their movement. And again, I'm just going to be a little bit biased. I think we have really great community members that are working hard at this.
Well, despite the fact that a number of your other colleagues, health directors and health district management may argue that theirs is the best,
probably, yes, will.
Probably something that is uniform across, I may be speaking out of turn here, but I think across the entire board of anybody who's in public health, you're all kind of standing there in a big group looking at a big black tunnel when it comes to May 20th, with a lot of unknowns, a lot of hopeful optimism. But how are you gearing up for, and how could you possibly prepare for the unknowns that might be inherent with the first phase of reopening Connecticut's businesses and economy?
Well, yeah, I will just want to say that I think that, you know, I don't know that. I think all the people are good and they're trying really hard.
Sure.
But and here in Newtown and Bridgewater and Roxbury, one huge benefit as we go into this May 20th and on is we've developed really great relationships with our food service industry and our businesses and community members. So there's a real relationship there. We've been sharing information right from the outset. We have regular email communications. We also go and visit them to see how they're doing, see if we can help out in any way. So, you know, it's not a, we're not trying to be restrictive. We're really trying to help solve problems. We know that this is new for everybody. It's new for us. It's new for them. It's always been our mantra that we want people to be successful. We want them to be safe and successful. So I think we have that benefit, and we know that we're going to learn and we're going to walk before we run. And hopefully everybody's going to kind of go along with that, because we want to learn and we want to do well along the way and be safe, of course.
Donna Culbert is the Newtown Health District Director, overseeing the community of Newtown as well as Bridgewater and Roxbury up in Litchfield County. Donna, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dan Rosenthal is the community's first selectman. And Dan, your community, within hours really of the state announcing a package of guidelines for the phase one opening, mm-hmm. your community was prepared with a permitting process. Donna talked a little bit about some of the unknowns, but it sounds like you've got a really good team here between your health district director, your land use and zoning people. Tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that you see going forward as your community reopens.
Well, I think you said it, John. I think I've benefited from having a great team. And I think that leadership is relying on that team. And I'm grateful that I live in a town and get to lead in a town that supports, you know, the government that we have, you know, that they support the staff and the fact that we had the resources and the talent to move quickly on this at the outset. We have an emergency management team that has a lot of muscle memory around, you know, this is uncharted territory for everybody, but it's not, you know, the first emergency that we've had to deal with where it required a lot of organization and everything. So, again, a team, you know, the team matters more than anything else, and I'm blessed to have the team that I do. I think when I think about challenges going forward, I'm grateful that I think everyone's efforts in the community to, you know, and in the area to sort of flatten the curve, if you will, you know, and make, you know, take the load off our healthcare workers as best we can. I think we have to remember that all that still matters a ton. So I'm happy that we're now in a position to say, let's, you know, get some people back to work and let's at least have some, you know, I hate to use the word normal, but start bringing some things back online. I think we are in a position to do it. I think we're in a position to do it safely. I think the challenge is just going to be, again, having people maintain the right discipline, call it physical distancing instead of social distancing. We need to keep doing those things. So I think we can enjoy a lot of the new things that are going to come back online. But it's really all that is predicated on our continuing to do the right thing from a distancing standpoint. And that will be the biggest challenge, is making sure that that continues to happen. I know our businesses are going to cooperate on that front. It's just a matter of getting everybody, you know, making sure everybody else is.
Dan Rosenthal is first selectman for Newtown. We are joined by him, Health District Director Donna Culbert, and Melanie White, the Area Operations Manager for Physician One Urgent Care at Newtown's first drive-up testing center here on Thursday, the 14th of May. I want to thank you guys for giving us a few minutes and inviting us here to experience this first of what may be a number of similar operations as we push toward controlling the COVID-19 virus in Newtown and across Connecticut. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, John.
We come around every year with a couple of old and dear friends of mine, one that's new to the award-winning For the People, though, and we're going to be talking about EMS Week, which begins today as we air the program on May 17th. It goes through May 23rd. This is the 46th annual National EMS Week, which was started in 1974 under President Gerald Ford to celebrate EMS practitioners and the important work that they do in our communities. And EMS Week brings together local communities and medical personnel to honor the dedication of those who provide the day-to-day life-saving services on medicine's front line.
it goes without saying that the front line has gotten a lot closer and a lot more dangerous, especially for EMS responders, which now includes not just EMTs, ambulance and paramedics, but also most of the individuals that are engaged in volunteer and paid fire services in your communities where you're listening to us on the radio or on podcast this morning. So we want to welcome our regular EMS Week guest. He is our perennial resource, Jeremy Rodrigo, a longtime EMT, an EMT and emergency medical instructor. He is a member of Beacon Hose Company Number 1 in Beacon Falls, and another Beacon Falls guy who is now Deputy Chief of Middletown's South Fire District that supplies fire and EMS services. James Trotsky's on the line with us as well. Gentlemen, welcome, and without further ado, let's start with you, Jim. What's it like out there now on the front lines with the added, 200% more responsibility of keeping you, your team safe, as well as taking the best care of the patients that you're encountering here in this COVID-19 world?
Well, hello, John, and once again, thanks for having me on board here to talk about the fire service interaction with EMS. And yeah, things have changed, and one of the things about how they've changed quite rapidly. We knew that COVID-19 was coming about. We started stockpiling some equipment and starting to change our response models based on that. But it was certainly a challenge to have this all happen within a 1 or 2 week time span. I could speak on behalf of us here in Middletown. We have 3 different response districts, fire-based response districts that offer first responder EMS. And we've gotten together collaboratively through the city, and we actually put a 3-tiered approach to our EMS responses as it comes in board with the COVID-19 crisis. Mm-hmm. And we've actually identified our patients as a red, yellow, and green. A red patient, meaning for us, a patient that needs life-saving interventions immediately. And those are the patients that we would get intimately involved with, get on all of our protective gear, N95 masks, or in some cases, a full self-contained breathing apparatus, and provide those life-saving interventions, whether it's airway management, AED, or CPR. And then we've actually identified a yellow patient, a patient who has some need to be transported to the hospital, unable to be transported on their own, but doesn't necessarily need life-saving intervention. So it's kind of a hands-off approach on that patient, where we're doing a more of a verbal triage of that patient, and actually, if they could get moving on their own, if you're ambulatory, get them closer to the exit point of the residence so that when the ambulance arrives on scene, they were able to transport them. And what that does is it alleviates our people from getting involved in the patient and the possibility of being contaminated, so that we could have a healthy workforce in order for other rescue and fire emergencies.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine
our greatest challenge.
Yeah, I was going to say, I imagine, going into a closed facility, whether it's a home or a business or some other location where there may be other individuals who are COVID positive, or, not having to worry about touching door handles or railings or countertops or furniture is all a big plus toward keeping your response team members safe. Tell us about that third level.
The third level is a green patient now, and here in Middletown, our system is a tiered approach where we're first responders. We have Westfield, Middletown, and South Fire District. Well, we will respond to every call and assess the patient and virtually get the patient ready for transportation with a commercial ambulance service. Here we use Hunters, and if we have an ALS, a person needing advanced life support, we have Middlesex medics come in and provide the advanced life support. So we now have tiered the approach down so that right now with a green patient, somebody who doesn't need any interventions at all, they will just be getting an ambulance. They won't be getting the first responder. Again, to keep our resources at a vital area so that, you know, there's less risk. We're trying to do a little bit of risk management. Now, this is only a temporary approach here. As we start, as things start to cool down a little bit with the hospitalizations, we're going to start increasing our response model back again.
Okay. Now, Jeremy, on the volunteer side in a relatively smaller community like Beacon Falls, are a lot of the practices sort of flavored the same, or are things a little bit different when the response time might be a little bit slower just because of the sheer demand on the volunteers to answer the calls?
Well, it has changed the way that volunteers respond, not just for us, but a lot of our neighboring communities. A couple of things that we've done. COVID-19 has made our responses a little slower, a little bit more methodical. So when we get a call for a potential COVID-19 patient, most of the time dispatch is able to let us know. We have to don a lot of PPE. We have minimized the number of people that respond to calls. So we try to lower the amount of personnel responding to any particular call to two, if possible. If the call requires more than two people, of course, we ramp up and bring more people in. We try to intervene with the patient prior to entering the house. So we try to talk to them from outside of the house before we walk into the house. Get a level of a sense of what their potential for having COVID-19 is. And then it goes into taking care of the patient. We've altered some of the methods that we use to resuscitate patients, for instance, to minimize the risk of aerosolizing saliva and some of the interventions that we use in terms of airway management. We've also developed a very robust decontamination process. So when the ambulance and the personnel come back to station, the entire ambulance from cab to patient compartment to stretcher to every piece of equipment that we use or touch is totally decontaminated with antibacterial spray. You know, the whole kind of way that we would normally go about answering a call has kind of been turned upside down because you want to make sure that in order to maintain our system and the health and vitality of our system, we need to make sure that the health and vitality of our responders remains intact. And the way that we do that is through really, really robust PPE and engineering controls so that we make sure that we, are staying as healthy and uncontaminated as possible. And it does have a tendency to kind of slow down a little bit our responses because we need to be, like I said, more methodical and more deliberate about everything that we do, every second of every patient interaction.
Yeah, because if the responder's taken out or responders are taken out of the picture because they have to self-quarantine or heaven forbid that they're affected with COVID, that's just going to exponentially make things worse in terms of your ability to get out there to the front line.
Yeah, it'll totally destabilize the EMS system. So I'm very proud of our members and even our surrounding communities that we've been collaborative with for many years. We've worked out this kind of regional approach to how we're going to maintain and stand up the system and keep it vital and keep it active and robust.
Very good. Well, the wild card, I guess, comes out of the deck when the call comes in for the person that fell down the stairs or the automobile crash or another incident or even a fire where you may need to respond to people who are in trouble, but you have no idea whether or not they may be COVID positive. In the last minute or so before we go into the break, Jim and Jeremy, each weigh in for a moment or two on how you now have to approach every situation that has that unknown.
No, you're absolutely right, John. And in lack of a better term, we're every incident response, we're treating it as it's hot. You know, we're in the fire-based industry. We're used to dealing with hazardous materials. We call it a hot, warm, and cold zone. So every time we respond to a call now, even if it's just a call for a service call, we're considering it hot. And echoing what Jeremy was saying is that we're reducing the amount of people that we're putting interacting with the public. So we have an engine company of four. Three of them may just stand by the engine while another one goes up to investigate. Also wearing universal precautions, whether it's a face shield, N95 mask, and gloves, or possibly a gown just to investigate a call.
Yeah, and that may help reduce the overuse or inappropriate use of PPE where it's not needed. So that sounds like a great practice. Similar on your end, Jer?
That's exactly the same thing where it's twofold, because, John, you brought up a good point. It minimizes the amount of PPE that we use, but it also protects our members. So we treat every patient, every interaction that we go to as if they're possibly COVID until we can rule out otherwise. And you mentioned the fire service. We had a fire call for a carbon monoxide alarm, and the person who lived in the home happened to be COVID positive. So they're out there.
Folks, as we're hearing, when we talk about frontline personnel, we are not just so appreciative of the folks in the hospitals that are doing their incredible work, but the ones who have to deal with the emergencies up to the point where the patient or the sick person is handed off to the hospital. Today is the first day of the 46th annual National EMS Week. It extends through May 23rd. And we are, as we do on this program for so many years, celebrating EMS practitioners and the important work that they do in every single one of our communities, more so now than ever. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about a bunch of the other things that EMS providers need to be dealing with. Stick with us. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our area? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting an awareness or fundraising activity, or you'd like to find one that's supporting a nonprofit in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find out how to promote it or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Boquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, did you know there are more than 15,000 people in Milford and Stratford alone without a high school diploma? And there are more than 1,600 adults in these towns who are not fluent in English? Well, you can help. A 5-week tutor training class is beginning online via Zoom starting May 20th with Literacy Volunteers of Southern Connecticut. Tutors will learn techniques to assist ESL students with dialogue, listening comprehension, oral fluency, phonics, reading comprehension, and writing skills, and no previous teaching experience is required. All prospective tutors will be interviewed in advance, and if you'd like more information, call 203-878-4800 or visit Literacy Volunteers of Southern Connecticut at lvsct.org. We are back, and we're so pleased to be helping to celebrate the 46th annual National EMS Week. Our longtime guest and resource on this subject, Jeremy Rodrigo, is with us. He's an EMT and longtime EMT instructor, a member of the Beacon Hose Company number one in Beacon Falls, and a dear old friend of mine, Jim Trotsky. He is a deputy chief of Middletown's South Fire District, supplying fire and EMS services in Middletown, Connecticut. We talked a lot in the first part of the segment about COVID-19 and how it's playing a role in impacting the work that EMS professionals and responders, EMTs, paramedics, and firefighters are facing every day. But this is by far not the only issue that is on their plates, as it has been for a number of years now. And we've talked about it before. We are still in sort of the throes of an opioid epidemic, which brings us to the issue of trauma and continued response to things like opioid overdose. Jer, let's start it off on that subject.
Yeah, we're certainly continuing to see a lot of opioid use, a lot of overdoses that are related to opioid crisis. I think, even with COVID-19, there is some information to suggest maybe we've actually seen a little bit of an uptick in it, but it's still out there. We're still using an awful lot of Narcan throughout our communities. We're saving lives in that regard, but one of the things that we're doing with that the state has done, and I think really well, was whenever we use Narcan, we now report to the state that we use Narcan and in real time, so that the state can prepare to follow up with that patient and offer services in terms of addiction treatment and, you know, and recovery and things like that. And so those systems are in place now. And even our emergency departments that we transport our patients to, our hospital ERs, are much more prepared to offer those addiction services and referrals to patients. It's more than just giving Narcan and reversing the overdose. It's all of the aftercare that we're really starting to ramp up.
Excellent. In terms of keeping the EMS responders as safe as possible, there's a couple of key partnerships that have really developed, in parallel over the years. For quite a long time, it's been those in the emergency dispatch capacity. And more recently, especially during the COVID-19 emergency, Department of Public Health Resources. Let me go to Deputy Chief Trotsky to talk a little bit about dispatch. These are really the individuals who are kind of true first responders in partnership with the folks who go out on the calls like you and your fire and EMS companies. Talk to us a little bit about the critical role that dispatchers are playing in making sure you guys are as safe as possible.
John, you couldn't have said any truer words that they are the initial first responders. And what most people don't realize is when they're calling the dispatch center, you're not just calling somebody who's taken down an address and they're dispatching a call. These people are trained professionals. They've taken telecommunicator courses. They are CPR trained, and most of them have medical background. And they are leading you through a series of questions, which is sending the appropriate level of help to your location. And although it may seem like they're keeping you on the line for quite a period of time, most of the time the other dispatchers that work in the dispatch facility are already dispatching the resources as the call taker is taking more and more information. And I have a great example of this, and it just leads to exactly how it was like almost a textbook call, where not too far from our fire station, we had a elderly gentleman go down with sudden cardiac arrest. His wife called 911 immediately. 911 dispatcher took the information, gave CPR instructions over the phone, and the woman had started to try to do some CPR on the person, immediately got us first responders. We were on scene within 2 minutes, defibrillated the patient, make him a viable patient in order for the paramedic to take over and for transport to the hospital, and the person has made a full recovery. So it is a total system that creates a great outcome. And it's the initial 911 dispatcher that makes the call.
Yeah, and that lag of 3 or 4 minutes, had that dispatcher not had a protocol to be able to intervene, could have been a life and death difference. Definitely, yeah. Critical. Jer, in terms of the Department of Public Health, they've always been overseeing emergency medical services in Connecticut, but now more than ever, they're armed with resources that can also help. Tell us about the Department of Public Health's role.
Well, we have EMS is overseen by the Office of Emergency Medical Services, which is a section of the Department of Public Health, and they have a very strong oversight into how EMS agencies throughout the entire state operate, and they develop protocols and establish guidelines and provide resources and services. And, you know, it continues to grow. You know, the levels of care that EMS providers are able to deliver in the field continue to increase and improve. And this is all thanks to Dr. Rich Kamen at DPH and the folks at OEMS, who continue to look at the EMS system and how it can be enhanced throughout the entire state at all levels, not just at the paramedic level, but at the first responder level and everything in between. And I think the relationship that EMS providers have with the Department of Public Health is very good, and it continues to improve.
Every single year when we celebrate EMS Week here on the award-winning For the People, we probably have touched upon the fact that when people call 911 because of an emergency, whether it's with somebody that they love or somebody that they don't know, it's most critically important to not only listen to everything that you're being told to do by the dispatcher, but also cooperating with those EMS crews and fire responders when they hit the scene. However, something we haven't really ever talked about before was how every other single person out in the world can help protect these EMS responders, especially if they're on the road. So whether it's an ambulance that's just parked on the side of your neighborhood street because they are going in and transporting a patient or giving some sort of medical care, to the terrific traffic crashes on our highways and municipal streets and back roads. There's a lot less traffic. A lot more people are driving a lot faster. They may not be paying as close attention. And that brings me around to our state law that dictates slow down, move over. Jim, we talked a few minutes before we went on the air about the reason why now when people are going by accident scenes, even minor accident scenes, they're seeing a lot of fire apparatus and other emergency vehicles. And a lot of that isn't necessarily because the equipment and personnel on those vehicles are needed, but the vehicles themselves are needed to shield those workers from the danger of passing traffic.
You're absolutely right, John. And we've learned, unfortunately, throughout the years with incidents that have happened and actually taken a life of first responders, is that we have to start emulating the state DOT and also with other construction workers, and we have to actually set up a safe work zone. And if, and I always use this analogy, is like if you're going down 84 or Route 9 or Route 8 and they're doing some construction ahead of you, you know way ahead of advance that maybe the right lane is going to be blocked. Unfortunately, in the emergency services world, we don't have a lot of time or the luxury to set up an early warning. So we try to what we call put a blocking pattern in place, and we're going to have one piece of fire apparatus that's going to be on scene where the personnel are going to be engaged in the emergency using those resources. And a little bit further upstream, you're going to maybe see a ladder truck or another larger piece of apparatus creating a safe shadow of a work zone in order to slow down and try to channel the traffic in one direction. And oftentimes people address me and say, "Chief, why are they bringing so much apparatus up onto the limited access highway?" And those are the reasons being, is that we need to create a safe zone for our personnel. More importantly, too, is the people coming by. We're living in a world of distractions now. People are distracted by the radio, by their cell phones, by their GPS, or maybe they're just curious of what the emergency scene looks like, and they're not taking the time to just slow down, drive through the scene, and worry about looking at what happened maybe later on with some other media or some news agency, and not putting our personnel at risk.
Good point. And Jeremy, to the point of just an ambulance and maybe a paramedic parked on a neighborhood street or a country road because they're dealing with a patient in a house there, the danger is equally great.
Yeah, absolutely. People oftentimes, Jimmy mentioned it, there's a lot of distractions in the world. And if you're used to zipping up your street to get home and you come around a blind corner and, you know, you find an ambulance parked there because you were caught off guard because you were going way too fast. You've got to consider that we don't always have the luxury of parking our vehicles neatly tucked away in a driveway or whatever.
Sure.
A lot of times we're in a hurry, or we can't get this because of the size of a vehicle. We can't get it into a particular location or a driveway. We try to always park our vehicles as safely as possible, but there are times that we've got to block roads and park in streets, or maybe have the nose of the vehicle out in the road. Just take a little bit of extra time. You see the vehicle, it's got its flashing lights on. Slow down, stop even. Think about people getting in and out of that vehicle in a hurry. Maybe they're not, maybe they're preoccupied with taking care of a patient. They don't have time to look over their shoulder all the time.
Right.
take the time and look for these guys.
Very good. Well, we want to cut our guests loose because they are doing important work. I want to thank Deputy Chief James Trotsky of Middletown South Fire District, supplying fire and EMS in Middletown. Jeremy Rodrigo, EMT, an EMT instructor, a longtime member of Beacon Hose Company Number 1, Beacon Falls. We want to thank every single paid and volunteer emergency medical service provider and responder here during 46th Annual National EMS Week. It begins today, May 17th, goes through May 23rd. We are celebrating all of you EMS practitioners, firefighters, paramedics, all the frontline responders, including we will include our emergency dispatchers for all the important work and life-saving work that you guys do. We can't thank you enough except to just issue our appreciations at this point. Guys, stay safe out there, and we'll see you at next year as we celebrate EMS Week again. Thank you. Well, we're going to be wrapping up the program this morning with something that we've never really talked about on the show before, transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS therapy. We're talking with Dr. William Sauve, and he is affiliated and regional medical director for Greenbrook TMS Neuro Health Centers, a dedicated center for the treatment of depression using transcranial magnetic stimulation. Dr. Sauve also recently co-authored The Science of Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation with Lawrence Crowther for the July issue of the Psychiatric Annals. He's also a member of the American Psychiatric Association and a faculty member at the Neuroscience Education Institute. We're so glad to have him with us today to talk about the ties between a TMS and the relief it may be able to provide for folks that are experiencing certain issues related to the coronavirus and the COVID-19 situation and in their lives in general. So it's great to have you, Dr. Sauve. Thank you for joining us here. Folks should know he's in the car traveling from one point to another. So you may hear some road noise or horn honking in the background. And so that is to be expected. We'll only have him on for about 10 minutes. So Dr. Sauve, welcome to the program. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So let's get right into it. People hear transcranial magnetic stimulation, and it really does, to the uninducted, maybe sound like something out of a science fiction movie. But in fact, it is a extremely viable and successful therapy. Tell us more about it.
Absolutely. So transcranial magnetic stimulation, the short version is that we're taking advantage of an electromagnetic field so that we can therapeutically stimulate brains in a non-invasive way. So this is a brain stimulation treatment, but because of the physics of electromagnetic fields, we can do this in an office-based, you know, very civilized environment, and people are able to, you know, literally watch TV while they're having their treatments, and it's brief and there's no after effects, and then people can, you know, move on with the rest of their day.
So in talking with a few people that I know who have experienced TMS, most of which with great success, it's interesting that for some people, the TMS interface has been something that's been kind of on the short side, just a few visits, and others who have found success after a longer succession of situations. Tell us a little bit more about what folks will experience if they're coming to one of the Greenbrook locations across the state of Connecticut for some assistance.
So this is a treatment that for a brief period, you do come to it 5 days a week. So I do warn people at the very beginning that it is a little bit of a commitment. A typical course of treatment would be about 20 to 30 total sessions. So maybe as many as 6 total weeks, you know, coming in for treatments Monday through Friday. To your point, I have seen people, you know, benefit from the treatment, you know, sometimes as quickly as a week. I would say the most common
that I've seen is closer to 3 weeks or maybe about 15 treatments in. But, you know, as you so astutely pointed out, that can sometimes be all over the map. So I let people know if they're feeling well within a week, that's probably not their imagination. But if they're not feeling well within a week, I encourage people to continue because it quite commonly manifests a little bit later.
So who are the folks who normally would benefit greatly from TMS?
Well, the treatment was FDA approved in 2008 for what the FDA called treatment-resistant depression. For perspective, on the label, treatment-resistant depression meant not getting better from just one medication trial. So in the medical label, it would be very appropriate to come to TMS very, very early in the course of depression treatment, having tried one drug, maybe not getting much benefit from it after no more than, I would say, 8 to 12 weeks. Mm. Now, for many people using insurance companies often require maybe 3 drugs or maybe 4 drug trials before they want to cover TMS treatment. So a little bit more strenuous than the FDA label, but still not necessarily that far into the course.
And have you found in the range of patients that you yourself, and this is speaking exclusively for yourself, have you found that people, a measure of them, have been able to get off of or disengage from antidepressant pharmacology by using TMS either in a concentrated amount of time or as an ongoing therapy?
That does happen. Interestingly, I think that many, many people are coming to TMS very late in the course, so that I find very frequently people that come to see me have suffered for decades and have had actually about an average of 8 attempts at medication therapy before coming to TMS. We're getting that population into remission, and I've been very delighted with the results that we've had with people who've been through so much. But I think a lot of them are staying on medications at that point because they're afraid to change. And I don't blame them because they very, very badly, sure, don't want to take a chance,
right,
on going back,
yeah,
to how things were.
Yeah, if it ain't broke, right?
If I see, well, exactly.
Yeah.
They don't want to change their socks,
right,
at
right,
that point.
Yep.
But I think I find with the more opportunities I have to treat people who are younger, the more people who have had depression for months as opposed to years, particularly if they've been seeing an aggressive doctor who went through the appropriate medication trials fairly quickly, which would be the appropriate, in terms of normal algorithms for treating depression. Those are the people that are, much, much more likely, if getting into remission with TMS, than to see how they do without medications. And that's a very appropriate plan.
Are you finding that since the COVID-19 emergency has struck, that people who may have been kind of living on the edge, so to speak, where they may have thought that they were having some mental health concerns or may have been quietly enduring anxiety or traumatic stress, are kind of crossing the barrier and coming to Greenbrook or to you for TMS treatment as an possible way to deal with it?
Yes, I think that is starting to happen. Which is exactly what I expected. And I think you'll find that most people who come in for care, they won't even necessarily, feel that it was because of recent events. But any sort of crisis, and COVID has absolutely been zero exception, you can expect the stress level of the entire nation to go up by a certain amount. And there will be a whole layer of people who've been getting by, which is a testament to their strengths. But that increase in 10 to 15% of general stress and general pressure was the thing it took for them to finally start to decompensate and come in and come looking for help. And I think we've seen this in the field after just about any major stressful event, going all the way back to 9/11 when I was a resident training in the Navy. We saw the exact same thing after an event like that you saw a flood of people coming in who were, they thought they were fine, but not really. and something like this helped push them into a state where they felt that they needed care. I'm really, really glad that we're having the opportunity to deliver that. So people are coming and, you know, maybe for the first time, they'll find some relief.
Well, people can learn all about it by going to greenbrooktms.com. Greenbrook provides transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS therapy, which, Dr. Sauvé said, is an FDA-cleared non-invasive therapy for the treatment of depressive disorders and other mental health disorders here in the U.S. The therapy provides local electromagnetic stimulation to specific brain regions directly associated with mood regulations, and as we're hearing, it works. We really appreciate you taking some time to orient us on this this morning, Dr. Sauvé. Dr. William Sauvé is a regional medical director for Greenbrook TMS Neurohealth Centers, and he has also recently co-authored The Science of Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation. You can look at it in the July issue of Psychiatric Annals. He's also a member of the American Psychiatric Association and a faculty member at the Neuroscience Education Institute. Dr. Sauvé, great to chat with you this morning, and thank you for this quick but very, very interesting orientation about TMS.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.